Hello, friends, and welcome to episode 1186 of the Juice Box Podcast. When Mary-Kate was 23 years old, she was pregnant, experienced a kinked cannula. That cannula put her into DKA, and it caused her to go into labor early, almost killing her and her unborn son. Nothing you hear on the Juice Box Podcast should be considered advice, medical or otherwise. Always consult a physician before making any changes to your healthcare plan. Don't forget to save 40% off of your entire order at CozyEarth.com. All you have to do is use the offer code JUICEBOX at checkout. That's JUICEBOX at checkout to save 40% at CozyEarth.com. If you have type 1 diabetes or are the caregiver of someone with type 1 and you'd like to help with T1D research right from your home, you can by going to t1dexchange.org/juicebox and completing the survey. That's it. It'll take you about 10 minutes. You can do it from wherever you're sitting right now on your laptop, your phone, your tablet, doesn't matter. t1dexchange.org/juicebox. You need to be a U.S. resident who has type 1 or is the caregiver of one. And just like that, you're helping. This episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by Touched by Type 1. TouchedByType1.org. And find them on Facebook and Instagram. Touched by Type 1 is an organization dedicated to helping people living with type 1 diabetes. And they have so many different programs that are doing just that. Check them out at touchedbytype1.org. Today's episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by Dexcom, makers of the Dexcom G7 and G6 continuous glucose monitoring systems. Dexcom.com/juicebox. Today's episode is sponsored by Medtronic Diabetes, a company that's bringing people together to redefine what it means to live with diabetes. Later in this episode, I'll be speaking with Jalen. He was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at 14. He's 29 now. He's going to tell you a little bit about his story. And then later at the end of this episode, you can hear my entire conversation with Jalen. To hear more stories with Medtronic champions, go to MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox or search the hashtag Medtronic Champion on your favorite social media platform.
My name's Mary-Kate. I've had diabetes since I was 12, which means about 13 years, and I had my first baby in November of last year of 2022, and it was kind of a disaster because of diabetes, so that's why I'm here.
Yeah, you're here to tell your baby-making disaster.
Yep.
It wasn't going poorly for a while, right?
No, it was, like, perfect. Perfect until the day he was born, literally.
Well, yeah. We'll get to that. First, Mary-Kate, let's figure out a little more about you. So you're 25 years old?
Yeah, my birthday is coming up. 24 now, but
Yeah. This is my favorite part of when it happens. Like when people are like, well, no, in a month I'm going to be. I'm like, oh, God, nobody cares. Just so you're 25, let's go. No. So you're diagnosed 12 years old. Was that puberty or pre-puberty or right as it was happening?
Right as it was happening. Oh, yeah.
A mitzvah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Any diabetes in the family, other autoimmune in the family?
No, nothing. Nothing.
To say you were surprised at diagnosis would be fair?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'd been feeling poorly for a while, so I wasn't surprised that something was wrong with me. But, you know, being like just a little girl, all you think about diabetes is, you know, that commercial of the guy saying diabetes. So definitely had no idea what was coming for me.
Poor Wilford Brimley. People have forgotten his name. It's okay.
There you go. Yeah.
So you weren't feeling well for a while. What did that look like?
I mean, all the textbook stuff, like we should have caught it even sooner than we did, honestly, because it was peeing like crazy, eating like crazy, drinking like crazy. I was in band at the time at school, and I played the saxophone. So that's a reeded instrument, and you have to keep the reed wet in order to play. And I was like unable to play my saxophone for the hour period at school because my mouth was so dry. I kept having to go out to the hall to get drinks of water from the fountain because it's just like so dehydrated.
Did you think you had a very absorbent reed in your saxophone?
I mean, I just thought I was thirsty, I guess. 12, you know, you're 12. You don't think something's wrong with you. You're just...
Listen, 12, 20, 60. Most people are like, I didn't think anything was wrong with me. I just thought, you know, blah, 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 whatever was happening to them. So how long does all this go on for before you end up at a doctor?
Well, my dad's a doctor, so not very long.
What kind of doctor is your dad?
He's like a family doctor, just general okay. practitioner.
Gotcha.
So not too long. I ended up going on vacation with my mom and sisters, and my dad and brother stayed behind. And that like close one-on-one time between my mom and I is when she was finally like, okay, you know, she's not being dramatic. There's something really weird going on here. So the day after we came back from that trip, I was in his office getting, you know, all the labs done. And yeah, sure gotcha. Enough.
He found it that way. Hey, how many brothers and sisters do you have?
Three.
Okay. Are you the youngest?
I am.
I could tell. All right. Well, I just could tell because your mom was like, she's not being dramatic, which means that your mom had lived through a couple of kids already. Okay. Why did you think I could tell?
I don't know. It's just usually a negative connotation when you're the youngest, like you're, you know, whiny or annoying or spoiled or.
Do you feel like you've been whiny for the first 6 minutes of this? No.
I hope not.
No, of course not. No, you've been terrific. No, I just thought if that was your mom's response, then you must be one of the younger kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's all. Okay, so your dad, that's weird. So you were diagnosed by your dad.
Yes.
How do you remember that? Like, is he the one that told you?
Yes, he is.
Was it a weird experience? Like your dad being was your dad always your doctor? Dexcom G7 offers an easier way to manage diabetes without finger sticks. It is a simple CGM system that delivers real-time glucose numbers to your smartphone, your smartwatch, and it effortlessly allows you to see your glucose levels and where they're headed. My daughter is wearing a Dexcom G7 right now, and I can't recommend it enough. Whether you have commercial insurance, Medicare coverage, or no CGM coverage at all, Dexcom can help you. Go to my link, dexcom.com/juicebox, and look for that button that says Get a Free Benefits Check. That'll get you going with Dexcom. When you're there, check out the Dexcom Clarity app or the follow. Did you know that people can follow your Dexcom? Up to 10 people can follow you. Right now, I'm following my daughter, but my wife is also following her. Her roommates at school are following her. So I guess Arden's being followed right now by 5 people who are concerned for her health and welfare. And you can do the same thing. School nurses, your neighbor, people in your family. Everyone can have access to that information if you want them to have it. Or if you're an adult and you don't want anyone to know, you don't have to share with anybody. It's completely up to you. Dexcom.com/juicebox. Links in the show notes. Links at juiceboxpodcast.com. And when you use my link to learn about Dexcom, you're supporting the podcast.
Yeah, like, you know, on paper, we would put one of his business partners, and if it was ever anything serious, he was very hands-off because he's like, you know, he didn't want his emotions or anything to get in the way. But for all the routine, you know, kid stuff, we always just, you know.
He'd take care of it.
Yeah, he'd do it at home, whatever. I don't know. It wasn't that big of a deal just because I had no idea what it meant. They had told me prior to the testing, like, you might have diabetes and that might mean that you have to take shots, you know. For a while, but they were very
vague.
They did not explain like the severity of the situation or that it would change my life forever. Or, you know, they didn't want to scare me, I guess, until they knew for sure.
I was just wondering if your dad wanted to be the one to say those things to you or if it's not nice to have a more removed person tell you something like that.
No, I don't think he wanted to be the one because even that day I was sitting in his office and he was like, well, all he said was, well, you do have it. He didn't say, you know, you do have diabetes and here's what's going to happen to you. He just said, you do have it. He didn't even call it what it was.
But Mary Kate, you can imagine from listening to all these episodes that he was probably incredibly upset.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. But now, he's, you know, stoic and quiet. So.
Oh, gotcha. Well, still, though, inside he must have been devastated. And now he's like, now he's probably stuck between, am I a doctor or am I her dad? Like, I don't want to be the one, like, I don't want her to think back on this moment and it's her father telling her. Like, I bet you there was a lot going through his mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
That sucks. Okay. So you find out you actually have diabetes. Didn't go to the hospital?
No. So that was a Friday. So he managed me over the weekend. He got me into an endocrinologist in a larger city that following Monday, and they took over my care.
Okay. Well, you remember, I mean, 13 years ago, doing the math, did you get a pump?
Yeah, actually, the insurance required 6 months of injections. So I did the bare minimum, and then I jumped over to Animas, actually.
You have the ping?
Yeah.
Yeah. You miss it?
Tandem's better, so.
Okay, good. I mean, not good, but like most people are always like, I miss my Animas ping. I don't know what the hell they're talking about. I've never used one, you know?
It was a great pump, but I mean, the pumps today are great too. Yeah, so, no, and we've got algorithms, right. So.
Yeah, I completely agree. Okay, so you got on a pump pretty quickly. Was living with diabetes 13, 14, 15 through high school, was it problematic for you? Did it go pretty smoothly?
It went as well as it could have gone, honestly. For the first, well, through middle school, I had a difficult time as far as just like self-esteem and, you know, I tried to hide it from everybody. So that part was hard. But as far as actually managing the disease, I was super independent with it. I really didn't want help. And honestly, did a great job, even as a middle schooler. And then in high school, probably later high school, more like junior year, senior year, is whenever I started like actually trying to educate myself on my own. And that's when I figured out like, oh, you know, you can actually have an A1C lower than 6 and you know, those sort of concepts. My endocrinologist, she was fine, but she had pretty low standards for what was successful. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I rode in between 6.5 and 7, probably like all the way up until senior year of high school before I figured out like that it was achievable and necessary to do better. Through college, I really got things under control. So
what led you to wonder if what you were doing wasn't enough?
I don't know. And I don't know if I even did wonder or if I just stumbled into that. I'll tell you what really like got me. Well, Dexcom made a big difference in my life, obviously. Yeah. And then the first thing that I stumbled across was like, you know, low carb lifestyle. And then from there, I found myself in a Bernstein Facebook group. Do you know about that guy?
Yes, a little bit. Yes.
Yes. So he's huge on the low carb thing. But anyway, he's got a YouTube channel. So I found myself down that rabbit hole. I read his book and his whole thing is he's very pro low carb, but he's also pro bold with insulin and teaches you, you know, how to bolus for proteins and fats in a way that nobody ever had. And he's like ancient, like in his 80s or 90s and, you know, has always been in the fives A1C wise. His big thing is to try to keep your blood sugar at 83. So that made me kind of have a light bulb moment of like, oh, the goal blood sugar doesn't have to be 120.
Right.
It can literally be 83.
Yeah. Your goal can be what you make your goal.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So somehow I found myself there and that's whenever I started striving for lower and lower.
Now, did that experience make you eat low carb or did it just make you shoot for lower numbers?
Yeah. I ate low carb for a couple of years.
It worked for you.
It did, yeah.
Why did you stop?
Because I like bread.
I like bread. That's a fair enough reason. This is a weird conversation for me because I'm of the opinion that people need to know how to use insulin. And then after they know how to use it, they should go forth and live their life any way they decide to. If it's,
right,
you know, 4 carbs a day or, I don't know, 40 or 100, whatever they eat, I don't care. I honestly don't care how people eat. But if you get too involved in conversations about how people eat, you will find extreme people on, you know, sides, like with anything else, who are ravenously upset with you. And I try not to have people ravenously upset with me, especially when I wish I could explain to them. I'm very happy for them that what they do works for them. I just don't want them. I'm in a weird position. I don't just make a podcast. I also have an incredibly like huge Facebook group. And so my concern always is that if a brand new diagnosed person comes in and it's like, I don't know what I'm doing.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
And someone comes in and says, if you just don't eat carbs, then this will be fine. Okay, fair enough. But it doesn't allow that person the opportunity to learn how to use insulin or what will happen if they have a piece of bread, which they are probably going to do at some point. Or, you know, what would happen if your five-year-old, you know, was low carb by your doing, and which would be fine. And then they leave for college one day and wonder what pizza is. And
exactly.
Now they have no idea how to bolus for these carbs. And so, again, to be very sincere, sorry, Mary Kate, you don't know the extraneous problems I have in my life, but you're probably starting to figure them out right now while I'm talking.
Yeah.
To be very clear, I do not care how people eat. I think if you eat low carb and that works for you, that's amazing. Like, fantastic. Congratulations. Woo. Good. Sincerely. But from a macro position, which is one I find myself in, having seen tens of thousands of people with diabetes start their journey or be lost in their journey or whatever, I can tell you that it's my opinion that understanding insulin is the first step, not removing carbs, because then you can sort of falsely make your way through, which is fine if you do it forever. But look at you, you're 25 and you're like, look, I want to have bread again. I can't do this anymore. Anyway, that's my point about that. I don't know why I do know why I had to say that. But I think it's cool that you found it. I think it's cool that it gave you the idea. And it's, you know, are you able to live in a way that you think is healthy now, not being low carb?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm fully bought into the juice box method at this point. And I do what I want, and I'm still successful with my diabetes, which is, for me, that's the best way to do it.
Good so. For you. Well, congratulations on finding your way to it. I think that's fantastic. Do you think if you would have found the podcast before hearing about low carb, do you think you'd still be in the same spot right now?
I don't know. That's a good question.
Yeah.
I might have tried out low carb anyways, because the time that I did it is when keto was like the biggest fad.
Huge, yeah.
So I might have just done it anyway just to see what it was like.
I think I should be clear. I don't eat a ton of carbs. I don't have diabetes, but I also I went to dinner the other night. I had beef. I had a little fish. There was a piece of bread on the table, like flatbread. I had one or two of them, but I think if there's no sugar in what I drank. I'm going to guess that at a dinner, I had, I don't know, maybe 25 carbs at dinner, you know, and probably the rest of the day, I probably didn't have 100 carbs that day. So, you know, probably, I mean, I think I definitely didn't have 100 carbs that day, and I don't most days. Carbs are tough, but I think processed food's a bigger problem, especially if you're using
insulin. Yeah, totally agree.
Right. So anyway, okay. So you're making it through, everything's going well. You get married at some point?
I do, yeah. When I graduated college, I got married.
And you've just recently decided we're going to make a baby. So that's the rest of this conversation. So you're married, you want to have a kid. Is your A1C already in a place where they're comfortable with you being pregnant, or was that something you had to work towards?
No, it was already there. So I had been in the fives for a couple of years at the point when I got pregnant.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. So you were well on your way to knowing what you were doing and having success over and over again.
Yes.
Gotcha. Okay. So we decide to make the baby, and here it comes. Tell me about the pregnancy. How did the first trimester go?
Pretty much textbook. I bought Jenny's book, so shout out to her. And that helped out a lot. I kind of knew what to expect. So a lot of lows first trimester, but nothing too crazy because I was well prepared. I have a great endo as well, who actually, whenever I found him initially, he was like my favorite. He was like, do you want to have a baby eventually? I'm like, yes. He's like, my favorite patients are pregnant women. He's like, Here's what you're going to do when you get pregnant. You're going to tell your husband, you're going to tell your mom, and then you're going to tell me. So he was very, very hands-on and super helpful throughout the whole thing. So that helped a lot.
And what he said about they're my favorite patients is because you're not going to see a woman with type 1 trying harder than when they're pregnant normally. Is that what his opinion was?
I think he meant from a more clinical side. Like he's obsessed with diabetes. He only does type 1. So I think he likes the challenge of managing a pregnant woman and likes, you know, all that he gets to educate and all that he gets to do. That's really what I think he meant.
Gets a little game day adrenaline from it, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think so. Oh, cool.
All right. So you're saying first trimester went about as you expected. It took you a little while to dial in insulin, get it right, so you didn't have lows. But other than that, pregnancy-wise, nothing out of the ordinary. Diabetes-wise, you were happy with where everything was. This episode is sponsored by Medtronic Diabetes. MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox. And now we're going to hear from Medtronic champion, Jalen.
I was going straight into high school, so it was a summer heading into high school.
Was that particularly difficult?
Unimaginable. You know, I missed my entire summer, so I was going to a brand new school. I was around a bunch of new people that I had not been going to school with, so it was hard trying to balance that while also explaining to people what type 1 diabetes was. My hometown did not have an endocrinologist, so I was traveling over an hour to the nearest endocrinologist for children. So, you know, outside of that, I didn't have any type of support in my hometown.
Did you try to explain to people, or did you find it easier just to stay private?
I honestly just held back. I didn't really like talking about it. It felt like it was just a repeating record where I was saying things and people weren't understanding it. And I also was still in the process of learning it. So I just kept it to myself, didn't really talk about it.
Did you eventually find people in real life that you could confide in?
I never really got the experience until after getting to college. And then once I graduated college, it's all I see. You know, you can easily search Medtronic champions. You see people that pop up and you're like, wow, look at all this content. And I think that's something that motivates me. Started embracing more, you know, how I live with type 1 diabetes.
To hear Jalen's entire conversation, stay till the very end. MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox to hear more stories from the Medtronic champion community.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, you're making changes constantly, like at least every week, if not more. And all throughout pregnancy, I was in the 5.0 range. I think I started pregnancy at like 5.3, pretty low. Mm-hmm. Now, as things went on, I did through second and third trimester, I was gradually getting higher and higher and higher. But I had not made it to a 6.0 A1C yet, even before delivery. Okay. So it was, I mean, yeah, I was getting higher as I went on, as you expect, but nothing dangerous. Everybody was happy with me. So it was all going really, really well.
Were you employing any of your low carb ideas to help?
I cut out all sugar, basically. But I mean, I was still eating bread.
Mm-hmm. You're like, the bread's the crux of this right here. Like, what's your favorite bread? Do you have, if I said that to you, would you like blurt something out?
Yes, I would blurt out sourdough.
Part of me wants to ask you what the second favorite bread is. I wonder if we can't make an incredible list for right.
No, I'm not that obsessive, but it's just delicious.
Yeah. I can't say otherwise. It's fantastic. I swear to you, like even just like a thin, like anything really, like I'm like, oh, like at dinner the other night, I'm like, what is this? And I opened the basket up and I was like, well, I'll try that. There was a little rye bread in there. I was like, I'll take a little rye bread. It's like kind of picking course. Through. It's fantastic. So you're not low carb, but you did cut out sugar. What did that mean for you? Like what had to leave your life for you to get rid of sugar?
My creative outlet is baking. And so I, for a long time, have baked like probably about once a week just for fun. So I completely let that go because I've never had the self-control to bake and then not eat what I've made. Mm-hmm. So for my whole pregnancy, I was just like, forget it. Like I'm not going to be making any desserts because I just knew it would be, you know, not good for me.
Pretty much the only place you're getting sugar from to begin with.
Yeah, no, I'm not That was it. I'm not a candy eater or anything like that.
I gotcha. So you thought if I cut out baking, did you find, I'm changing my thought midstream, but did you find like a black hole for your creativeness? Like, did there something else you could do with your creativity, or what did you do to replace it?
No, I guess I'm not a very creative person anyway. So it's not really that like big of a deal for me to just kind of turn that off.
Okay.
So yeah, I didn't really replace it.
Did your husband lose weight during your baking shutdown?
I don't think so, actually.
I would probably have been grateful if I was, and I'd be like, oh my God, I'm always eating that bake stuff she makes.
No, he gave me a really hard time the whole time because I always do a really big birthday cake for him, and he didn't get his birthday cake.
Oh my gosh, you were serious about it. Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Are
you a rule follower in general?
For good rules, not for stupid rules.
I gotcha. But once you decided that was it, there was no like, well, I'll make you a birthday cake.
No, because it was about me. I wouldn't have had the self-control.
Not to eat that birthday cake.
Yeah.
Oh, good for you. Good for knowing and well done, like actually following through on it. That's pretty impressive, actually. All right, so you're welcome. Second trimester, do things start to change?
Not really. No. I mean, they change by the book where, you know, you're slowly needing more and more and more insulin every single week. But, you know, it was manageable.
What was your basal rate when you started your pregnancy and how did it move up?
I would say my average basal rate pre-pregnancy was probably like 0.6, 0.7. Mm-hmm. And then by the end of pregnancy, my average, which I only made it to 33 weeks. So when I say the end, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
By the end, my basal average was probably like 1.5, 1.6.
Would you mind telling me what you weighed when you got pregnant?
When I got pregnant, somewhere between 125 and 130.
Okay. How much did you gain while you were pregnant?
15 pounds.
Look at you showing off. Okay. Hold on a second. 0.6, 0.7, up to about 1.5. Well, that is interesting because it's not about your weight. It's about the hormones and everything that's happening inside of your body, where the need goes up like a full unit an hour. That's something, isn't it? 24. That's 24 more.
Yes.
Yeah. Units a day.
A lot of extra insulin. And it affected my carb ratio as well. That was actually the bigger impact. By the end of pregnancy, like my breakfast carb ratio was 1 to 3.
What was
which for me is crazy.
What was it when you started?
Either 1 to 6 or 1 to 5. They're different for meals for me, but
it doubled, huh? How about that? So you probably added 30 or 40 more units a day being pregnant.
A lot. Yeah. I don't know, but that's a lot. Something?
That's so interesting. I mean, I know it happens, but it's still incredibly interesting. Yeah, you know. Okay, but you managed it and you expected it and stayed with it. Jenny's book helped with that.
Definitely.
Good. Yes. Good. Did you listen to any of the pregnancy episodes of the podcast?
Yes. Yes. All of them, actually, which that also helped. I kind of had a roadmap.
Okay. Great. Oh, that's good to know. Okay. So things are going along. You're cruising. Let's just be honest. It's a humble brag, but you're cruising through pregnancy, doing a fantastic job making this baby. And are you working during the pregnancy?
Unfortunately, I was. Yes.
I think that every day when I'm working too. Unfortunately, I'm working. And I've never once had to carry a baby except in my hands. Okay, so you're working, you're pregnant, it's going really well, and you get to 33 weeks, and it sounds like that's when the train comes off the track. So what happens?
Mm-hmm. What happened? Okay, so I got the flu.
Mary Kate, you are not supposed to get sick when you're pregnant. You're like have like super immune system when you're pregnant. Did someone lick you with the? Is it your husband's fault? This is what I'm trying to get at.
It's not his fault. Okay. Unfortunately.
Right. It would be so much better if you could hold it over his head for the rest of time immemorial. But okay, so you get the flu. I'm sorry. Keep going. I apologize.
Yes, I get the flu probably. So my baby was born on a Wednesday. I started feeling sick on the previous like Saturday or Sunday. I know I didn't go to church on that Sunday because I was under the weather. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I mean, I was just kind of managing at home. I was feeling bad enough that I knew it was either flu or COVID probably.
Okay.
But with both of those, it's kind of like, oh, well, you know, there's no treatment. I mean, Tamiflu, if you get there early enough, but maybe that'll help, maybe it won't. And maybe they'll give that to you if you're pregnant, and maybe they won't. Mm. So I was just kind of hanging low, resting a lot. And then actually, I started getting worried, like, okay, I have diabetes, I probably have the flu or COVID, and I've got a baby. At this point, all I'm concerned about is the baby.
Yeah.
I had a maternal fetal medicine appointment on that Tuesday, and I like pretended not to be sick, because this was back when, like, if you had any sickness symptoms, they wouldn't let you come to any appointments because they thought you would have COVID or whatever.
You pretended not to have the flu?
Yes.
You just think you look like you were on heroin when you walked in, maybe, or something? Because it's hard to pretend not to have the flu. How did you accomplish that? I'm interested.
Well, I managed to do my hair and do my makeup, so I would look a little
alive.
Better.
Yeah.
And they required you to wear masks anyways, so that was really the saving grace.
Okay.
So I wore a mask. I took like a hot tea with me so I could try to keep the cough like at bay, because I'm just thinking, like, I have to check on my baby or I'm going to go crazy, you know, worrying about him.
Right.
So I fill out the questionnaire and say, you know, no, I don't have any sick symptoms and all that. And he was perfect. So I make it through the appointment. They're like amazing. You know, they did an ultrasound, everything was great. They said, get out of here. The next day is when crap hit the fan.
Wow. And it happened very quickly. Is that correct?
I would say it was very quick.
Yeah. And so did you think, because I know what happened, right? I know how, but what did you think was happening at first? Like, were you blaming the illness is what I'm getting at?
I thought that it was, so what happened, I'm by myself all day, the day. So it's a Wednesday, the 16th. I'm at home alone all day. Mm-hmm. So I'm just like vegging out, watching movies, feeling like crap, whatever. And then around, like, I don't know, 6 p.m., I start having cramping. And so I think this is Braxton Hicks, right? I'm 33 weeks. So Braxton Hicks would be totally normal for that right. to start happening to me. So that's all I thought. Once I started having this cramping, I just associate it with the pregnancy. And I think it must be Braxton Hicks. Everything must be fine. This must be normal. It's kind of where my head starts out.
And do you call your dad? I always wonder. Every time you mention something, I wonder if you call your dad.
No, I did not call my dad.
Okay. No reason. Just it's not what you do.
Well, I guess I just didn't want to freak anybody out. I'm always afraid of making something into a bigger deal than it needs to be.
I see.
So I was afraid that either, you know, I would be dramatic and it would become a whole thing when it didn't need to be, or that he would be dramatic and tell me to, you know, yeah. go to the ER, which is what I should have done, but, you know.
Right. So you're sitting there, you're watching your movies, you're having your cramping, and mm-hmm. you think it's normal. How long till you believe mm-hmm. it's not? Like, how long did you live in that before you thought, ooh, I should do something?
Maybe only like 15 or 20 minutes before I text a friend who mm-hmm. had recently had a baby. And I'm like, because they're getting progressively more painful. And I'm just like, how bad are Braxton Hicks supposed to hurt? Because, you know, like, what the heck? This is hurting really bad at this point. And of course, you know, this is texting and she can't see me, you know, whatever. And basically she's like, yeah, they can hurt pretty bad. So I'm like, all right, I guess this is just how much pregnancy and labor and Braxton Hicks sucks. So I just get in the bath and like try to, you know, manage the pain basically. And so as I mentioned, I was home alone. So my husband was actually an hour away. And he was, at the time, he was in professional school and he was going to be getting out of class in 30 minutes. And I was like, I can ride this out for 30 minutes and, like, you know, see how I am, see if it gets worse. Again, like, not be dramatic and wait till he gets out of class to call him. So that's what I did.
Mary Kate, let me ask you a question. How much of that is growing up with a physician and hearing stories about people who are always running to the doctor when they don't need to, or like you programmed that, like, you don't go unless you have to?
I'm also a nurse myself.
Ah, okay. Now we're getting to it. So, I understand. Okay.
Yeah. I was trying not to admit that, I guess, but yeah. So I'm definitely programmed to, you know, I don't know, not make a big deal about everything.
Right.
And I also feel like whether or not it's true, I've always been told that I have a low pain tolerance. So I'm thinking like, well, maybe I'm just literally the world's biggest wimp. And, you know, so I need to wait until this really hurts.
You got to be careful about that stuff. My wife grew up being told she had a terrible sense of direction. And of all the people I know, she has the best sense of direction of anybody. So I think she just got lost one time when she was 16 in the car and people like tagged her with, you have a bad sense of direction.
Right. You know? The things people tell you can really
stick to you.
Get in the way of your thinking.
Okay. So you're like, Mary-Kate, you're a baby. You know, you're a baby. Everybody tells you that. So just stick it out. This doesn't hurt. Other people wouldn't. Meanwhile, who cares? Pain is pain. It is whatever it is to you, but I take your point.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Exactly. I'm sorry. So moving forward, what do we do?
7:30 hits apparently is when he got out of class. So that's when I called him and I'm like, at this point, I think I'm in labor because the pain is just like through the roof. Like I'm not able to be quiet anymore. I'm like in a lot of pain. So I call him in a big tizzy. Like, I don't know what's going on. Maybe I'm in labor. This hurts so bad. Like, you got to get here or whatever. And he's like, what the heck are you doing? Why haven't you called 911? Basically.
You're calling me for? I'm in grad school. I don't know anything.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he's like, I'm going to call an ambulance. And I'm like, don't do that. Call the OB emergency line. So I convince him to call the OB emergency line instead of 911. So he hangs up with me, calls them, and lo and behold, they don't answer. So he calls me back and is like, I mean, this is all much more dramatic than I'm replaying it for everybody, but
just so you all know, there's screaming and yelling and you guys are yelling at each other and there's high pitches.
Yes.
And yeah, I got you. Go ahead.
Exactly.
You should have called 911. What are you doing? And you're like, I just thought that it was like that kind of.
pretty much.
Okay.
Pretty
much. I got you.
So he calls back and he's like, they didn't answer. I'm calling 911. Forget it, basically. He's pretty cool under pressure. And obviously, with the way that I was freaking out, it was like obvious that that's what needed to happen. Mm-hmm. So he calls 911 to come pick me up. Meanwhile, he's like, you know, trying to fly. He's an hour away. So he's trying to fly back to where I am as fast as possible because we don't, you know, mm-hmm. we don't know what's going on. His side of the story is he thought with when I called that the baby had already died. He was like, I thought that, I don't know, like he just died inside of you and your body was trying to, you know, give birth to our dead kid. So he's freaking out.
Oh my God. Jeez.
Yeah.
He took a leap, huh? That's something.
Yeah. So calls the ambulance. Ambulance gets to my house probably around like 8 or so. He called 911 around 7:45. And the ambulance takes me to the nearest hospital.
Not the hospital you work at, though, right?
No, thank God. No.
Okay. Right. I was wondering if that was part of the reason you didn't want to call or not.
No. I commute to work. So that was.
Okay. Not the issue. He must come in like hair on fire when he gets there.
Well, he doesn't get there in time.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. Keep going. Look at you. Mary-Kate, look at you telling a story. Good job. Keep it going.
So, yes, ambulance takes me to the nearest hospital, which thank God, I live in a big city. So it's a very, very good hospital. And it's a hospital that has a NICU and a level 4 NICU, thank God. So anyway, but I get there, whenever the ambulance gets here, I'm like, at this point, I think probably having a panic attack. Like I'm just screaming, like freaking out about everything. Everything hurts, but I think in my mind, I'm also like really multiplying the pain because I'm so terrified about like mm-hmm. what's happening to me right now. So I get wheeled in to like labor and delivery ER or whatever. And I was in too much pain to lay on the stretcher or the gurney or whatever. So I got on it on my hands and knees. That was more comfortable. So I can't see anything. And I like can't move out of this position either. So I'm like just looking at the floor, but there's a million people running all around me. Everyone's freaking out, probably because I'm freaking out. But eventually they flip me over and they everybody's poking me for labs and IVs, and they're putting the contraction monitor on me, and they're trying like hell to get a Doppler on my baby to see how the baby's doing. That's whenever I hear somebody yell out, the heart rate's only 60. And if you don't know anything about babies, a baby in utero heart rate's like very, very high, 150, 160, something like that. Mm-hmm. So then I really start freaking out because I think my baby's going to die.
Yeah, and you actually know what that number means. So yeah. Yeah, a lot of people wouldn't know, but you did. How about that? Okay. So now you're flipping out more.
Now I'm flipping out more and I'm literally screaming at the top of my lungs, where is my husband? Where is my husband? And nobody, which I've been on the other side as a healthcare provider in like a life or death emergency. And I understand why. It's like, you really don't have the capacity or the time to address the patient's needs, mm-hmm. but oh my God, nobody would talk to me. They're all just like doing things to me, but no one is talking to me. Nobody would answer me where my husband was or tell me what was happening or what they were going to do to me. It's just horrible, horrible, like mad panic chaos. They do a cervical check and I'm not very dilated. Yeah. She was like, the OB yells at me. She's like, I need to do a cervical check on you because if you're dilated, you need to push right now and deliver this baby. Otherwise, we're going to the OR. And so I'm like, okay. And, you know, she does it, whatever. I was dilated to like a 2 or something. Yeah. So that was it. They pretty much immediately wheeled me off to the OR. And next thing I remember is finally a nurse. I'm still screaming, where is my husband? Because like I just needed so badly for somebody to like speak to me like a human being, to calm me down. And of course, I wanted him to do that.
Yeah. Also, Mary-Kate, I think it's important to point out, you're a really mature person. I don't know if you know that about yourself. But you're not that old. So, like, it's all well and good to be mature and, like, you know, have your head about you because you have a job or you have to and stuff like that. But once it happens to you, you're 20. How old are you at that moment? Are you 23?
Yeah, I was 23.
Yeah, you're like a baby yourself. You know what I mean? Yeah. And like, and you don't, I know, listen, I've only been talking to you for 45 minutes, but I would definitely come get you if there was a problem that didn't involve you because that I think you'd be really rock solid. And it sounds like you grew up in a serious household with, you know, doctors and, you know, you went on to be a nurse, et cetera. But like, it's the whole time you're talking, all I could think is you're my son's age and he's almost not qualified to deal with anything. So, you know, and I remember being young too, when Kelly was having cold, she was pretty young. And I look mm-hmm. back now and I see myself through my eyes now, and I can see myself through how I thought of myself back then. Like, we thought we knew what was going on and that we were handling things. And and we were, but like, as I look back on myself now, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. So anyway, it's been ringing in my head the whole time you're talking, like, how old were you when this was happening? So anyway, I'm sorry. So they knock you out and give you a C-section, or you go out from the pain? How does that work?
Yeah, they knock me out. So I feel like the, you know, ORs are so freaking cold. So I remember, finally, as we're running to the OR, a nurse comes right up to my face and she's like, what's your husband's phone number? And in that moment, somehow I remember his phone number. So I recite it off to her. And then the next thing I feel is just like that cool blast of air of being in the OR. And so I'm like, okay, like I know what's going on.
Right.
And then the OB again, like is screaming and she's like, we're going to do a lot of things that are going to be really uncomfortable, but I'm trying to save you and your baby's life. And then I just feel like this big dump of cold liquid on my belly, which I think was them literally just dumping betadine on me, as mm-hmm. opposed to like doing the proper,
right,
you know, swabbing, sterile process.
Yeah.
And then the anesthesiologist comes over my head and he's like, this is going to burn. And then he just slams in whatever anesthetic he used into my IV.
I think it's the propofol. That stuff burns. I've had it before.
It probably was the Jackson juice.
There's an, by the way, for anybody who's wondering, I know you're like, please let Mary Kate keep telling her story. But if you ever have to have it in a non-emergency situation, they can cuff your arm and put, they can put in something else that numbs it and takes the stinging away. I can't think of what it is, like Benadryl or something like that. It's probably not Benadryl. You probably shouldn't listen to me for medical stuff, but ask the anesthesiologist, isn't there something you could put in there to stop the burning? Because there is. So
yeah, it burned like hell.
Oh, I've had it. It feels like fire rolling up your arm and across your chest, and it feels like your heart's going to burst when it gets to it.
Yep.
And the issue is right as you think your heart's going to burst, you just fall asleep. So,
yep.
But anyway, keep going. So the burning comes, you're soaked in betadine, someone's talking to you about saving your life and the baby's life, and you...
And I go out. I remember the horrible burning and screaming from the burning. And then he slaps the face mask over my screaming face. And then it's lights out from there.
Wow. My God. Well, they saved your life, obviously.
They did.
Yeah. And we've already talked about your son. So I feel like everyone knows. This was like the Titanic where you're like, I wonder what's going to happen in this movie. Like the boat's going to sink for sure. But we knew you guys were going to be okay. So what happened? Like, why were you suddenly from months and months and 33 weeks of this is easy, my A1Cs are terrific, my blood sugars are great, I'm cruising to holy hell, I should call an ambulance. What the hell happened that day?
So, as I already told you, I got the flu. And as every good little diabetic knows, the flu predisposes you to DKA or, you know, any sickness. Mm-hmm. So I had that going against me and wasn't really thinking about that properly. And the day of my son's birth, I changed my pump site around like noon or one. So I did that and then basically laid on the couch doing nothing. I was snacking like, I don't think I'd even really eaten for the entire day. I was just sort of nibbling on some Wheat Thins and drinking like some Gatorade Zero. Mm-hmm. So I look back at my CGM graph in preparation for this, and up until the birth, my blood sugar didn't even go over 150 for the day because I was basically just laying there, not even really eating, but changed my pump site around noon or one. Then if you look at my CGM graph, around 5 p.m., I go over 180. And then, as I said, I kind of started all this cramping around like 6 p.m. Mm-hmm. And by 6 p.m., by 6 p.m., I was over 250. And by 7 p.m., I was over 300. And 7 p.m. is when I called my husband and the ambulance got there sometime around 8.
Yeah.
My son was born at 8:44.
Okay.
And at 8:44, my blood sugar was 297.
Were you bolusing in the afternoon while you were going up, or were you too sick to think about it?
Yeah, I was bolusing. But like, so I changed my site around noon or one, and I didn't even go over 130 until 4:15. Mm-hmm. Didn't go over 180 until 5:05. So it's just like, it happened slowly until I got, you know, like a double arrow up. But, so from like noon or one till four, I mean, I wouldn't correct for anything until I go over 130. So from then I'm not doing anything about it. And then, yeah, once the pain got so bad, I totally wasn't even thinking about diabetes
anymore. Right.
Like I forgot about diabetes.
So, I mean, I'm assuming most people have figured out what happened by now, but just say it.
So my freaking cannula was kinked.
Yeah, you had a kinked cannula. You were in DKA.
I was in DKA.
You had not had nearly enough insulin since noon.
Yeah, exactly. So I wasn't, I wasn't eating properly, which I should have been because, hello, you have the flu. Like you should be doing those boluses. I should have been drinking regular Gatorade, not Gatorade Zero, and been doing boluses for that or something. But I wasn't. I mean, I wasn't taking good care of myself from like a sick day perspective. Mm-hmm. And then My fatal flaw is I put my pump site on like my love handle area. And by then my belly was so big that I couldn't like twist around to look,
to see it.
Which I'm using Autosoft 30s, so it's not a perfect view anyways, but you could at least see condensation kind of collecting if you had a bent cannula. Mm-hmm. I do remember looking in the mirror before I called my husband, trying to see, like, is there condensation there? Because I had had that thought, because by that point I was pretty high, but yeah.
So just
too little, too late.
I just want to mention for people that you can be in DKA without a high blood sugar. Like, just not having insulin can put you in DKA. So if you're not pregnant and that happens, maybe you eventually think, this is the cannula. You might reintroduce insulin to yourself, and in a couple of hours later, feel okay again. Like, you might have been able to hydrate and bolus your way out of that. Like, it's just, but the DKA threw you into labor. Is that what you think happened?
They're not sure. That's kind of what it
is. Yeah, I mean, no one's going to know. Right.
Yeah. That's kind of what it seems like. Another theory, so it wasn't even my OB who ended up delivering me. So my actual OB, whenever I tell her the whole story, another theory she had is maybe the DKA put me in such severe dehydration that, like, I had lost so much amniotic fluid that I was having horrible cramping. She said she's seen that happen before. Or maybe it was labor. It's kind of weird that I was only dilated to a 2 if it were labor and the pain was so bad. But, you know, who knows?
Yeah. I mean, you can Google DKA causes early labor and get a number of different things that are interesting to read. But we're not going to do them now. But that's but that's crazy. Like, a kinked cannula. You are on the cruise of all cruise pregnancy. You get the flu, which you probably would have been okay with if the cannula didn't kink. And then that quickly, all that happened.
One mistake is sometimes all it takes to literally ruin your life.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say ruin the cake. I thought you were going to go back to the baking thing, which would have been amazing. But ruin your life is much easier because you were close to being dead. Do you think that's true?
I don't know. I think I would have been okay. I was, when I got there, I was like, I mean, I was not doing well. I kind of like looking septic. I have my heart rate was like what my babies should have been. I was like way up,
right?
130s, 140s, 150s, and my blood pressure was super low. So I wasn't doing well. But in terms of like acidosis, I wasn't actually doing that bad. My pH wasn't horribly low.
When did they start managing your blood sugars after the emergency C-section? Because it's not like you didn't roll in there going, hey guys, by the way, I have the flu. And I changed my site today, so God knows, maybe that cannula is like, you didn't have those conversations with anybody. So how long did it take them to figure all that out?
Well, I actually did tell them, I did manage to get, because, you know, they're asking you questions. So I managed to get out, you know, I'm 33 weeks, 3 days pregnant. I do have an OB because when they see like a horrible situation like this, they kind of just assume that you're an idiot and maybe you haven't even had any OB care. So. That I was able to get that out. I was able to get out that I had type 1 diabetes, and I was able to get out, I think I have the flu. That's like all the personal information that I gave them.
Good for you. Mary-Kate, is that because you're a nurse that you thought to make sure to squeeze that all out, do you think?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah,
I'm like, they've got to know all this.
Right. That's well done. Are you a different person professionally now because of your experience?
I don't know. I think about that a lot. I'm sure it's affected the way that I treat my patients, but I'm not sure in what ways.
Yeah. Do you know Arden was in the emergency room last weekend twice?
Oh no.
She had lower stomach pain that we couldn't figure out. It looked like appendix at first. Anyway, she's at school. She ends up in an emergency room. They had her there for 12 hours. They didn't help her. They were like, oh, this isn't your appendix. They booted her.
Yeah.
Then she ended up back there the next day because it had looked like, okay, maybe it wasn't an appendix, but it feels like it could be gallbladder now because some other symptoms arose. And she finds herself back in the emergency room for 12 more hours. So Arden spent 24 hours in an emergency room over 48 hours. And I would like you to guess how many times someone checked her blood sugar.
Oh, God. Maybe, like, I would say at most twice on each occasion.
Yeah, would never surprise you.
Wow, never.
Never. No one ever checked to see what her blood sugar was the entire time she was in either time.
Wow. Did they even ask her? Were they like, do you have a CGM?
No, they never talked about her diabetes. She was managing it and I was managing it remotely.
What a disaster. Yeah. I mean, it's most of my colleagues have no idea how to manage it or have no idea what type one is for dang sure.
Also, keep in mind, she was rocked on morphine both times. So wow. If something did go wrong, she wasn't in the right mind to take care of it either.
Right.
Arden's course, a lightweight. Yeah. Arden doesn't drink. She doesn't do anything. So you hit her with morphine, she's over pretty much, mm-hmm. You know? And so I was managing it the first time remotely. The second time I got on a plane and flew to where she was because of how bad the first time went.
Yeah. I don't blame you.
Yeah. So anyway, she's doing better now. But that's not good. The point. That's not the point of me bringing this up. The point of me bringing it up is she was 19, clearly scared, had something she couldn't figure out. They didn't know. She got there, said, I have type 1 diabetes, like, you know, told them the whole thing. No one ever once looked.
It's just embarrassing, honestly. Like,
I didn't yell at anybody when I got there, but I wasn't nice. And I finally got them to do the testing they needed to do so we could rule out the things that needed to be ruled out. They were trying to treat her the second time without checking her gallbladder after having her there for 10 hours.
Jeez. And ERs are just so dumb.
Yeah. When I got there, a man was standing over top of her and her roommates, and he was badgering them to leave.
Wow.
And Arden, about 15 minutes before I was able to get there, she said to him, I demand that you admit me.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the only thing that froze him long enough for me to get there. Like, she didn't really want to be admitted, but she's like, I knew they were kicking me out, and that if I asked to be admitted, he wouldn't be able to kick me out anymore.
Right.
So she froze him and she was like, I demand to be admitted. And that was it. Like, that gave me enough time to Uber from the airport to where she was.
So, that's crazy.
Yeah, anyway, it went great. Good job. I'm not going to say the name of the hospital, but you're a disaster. So cool. What'd you name the baby?
Jude.
Nice. You call for him? Hey, Jude.
Yeah,
sometimes. I mean, I would. Does it make you sing after you call for him?
Or is your brain? Yeah, of course.
I was going to say, is your brain not as simple as mine? Because I'd be like, hey, no, Jude. And then, I would start singing.
Pretty simple, yeah.
That's so wonderful. And he's fine, obviously, but he was early. He was 7 weeks early. And so he was definitely not done cooking. What did he have to be in the NICU for a while?
Oh, yeah, you're just getting to the, well, I guess for me, it's the worst part of the story. Maybe not objectively the worst part of the story. I was, you know, they put me to sleep for the C-section. And the last thing that I had heard about him was that his heart rate was 60. But by the time they got him out, he actually had no heartbeat. Oh. So they resuscitated him there in the OR and were able to bring him back. So they resuscitated him and intubated him. And then he was in the NICU for 6 weeks.
Wow. That's a long time. Was it touch and go at any point, or was he just too small to come out?
Like, they were pretty confident with us that he was going to survive. They were really scared that he was going to have like severe brain damage. And they were very upfront with us about that. Just because nobody knew like how long, I mean, frankly, he was dead. No, nobody knew for how long was he dead before they brought him back. In a baby, that's a big deal to not have oxygen to your brain for any amount of time.
Right.
That was the main concern. We were pretty sure he was going to make it. But yeah, he took a really long time to recover. Just respiratory-wise, took a long time to get off the ventilator. And then, you know, I recovered from my acidosis within like 24 hours, but it took him like, oh my gosh, like six or seven days. So my DKA like put him in metabolic acidosis. My blood was so toxic and tainted, and he's just getting all of it, obviously. So when they got to him, his blood gas was just a disaster. So that was kind of the main thing that took so long. And then once they had all that corrected, it was just kind of your normal NICU stuff of getting him big and getting him able to eat and breathe on his own and everything.
And do you feel like there's any deficits?
No. Oh my God. No, he is. Wow. He's right on track. He's doing amazing. Like, and he's huge. people have no idea ever that he was a NICU baby.
Yeah. How old is he now?
He is almost a year. He's 11 and a half months.
Wow. Oh, congratulations. That's lovely.
Thank you.
Did you name him after St. Jude?
No, but we did learn after the fact. We're not Catholic, but we are Christian, and we learned after the fact that St. Jude is the saint of impossible prayers.
Yeah, desperate cases and lost cases, right? Or lost cases and lost causes, maybe?
Yes, yes. Right. Something like that. And that was just like, wow, what a God thing. Because for us, the only way we survived, the only way he survived is just the flooding of prayers that we had from our community going out for him. And just the way that he's completely fine now is kind of mind blowing. So he's definitely was an impossible prayer.
I'm risking freaking myself out here. Did you pick that name before the day or after?
No, it was like 3 days after, okay. Actually.
All right. Because if you were like, we were going to call him Jude the whole time, then I'm freaking out. But I'm okay with that. Well, you made a sad song and you made it better. Is that the line? Took a sad song and made it better.
Yes.
Right. So what are we going to call the episode? Hey Jude? Probably, right?
I mean, that'd be pretty cute.
Yeah, I think that's what we got to do. Well, that's a lot. Mary Kate, I'm emotionally spent from having this conversation.
I'm sorry.
No, seriously though. It really is crazy that it's that one moment. Like, listen, I've had that happen, right? Arden had a pod that had to be changed while she was swimming. And so there'd been all this activity during the day. And so we expected her to have like lower blood sugars in the evening because of all the activity in the swimming. People know this, right? So we changed the pump. It is literally Arden's been using Omnipod since she was 4. She's 19. That's 15 years. In 15 years of using Omnipod, that's changing one every 3 days. She's only ever had one kinked cannula.
Oh, wow.
And it happened after that swimming. And so she wakes up the next morning. She's in DKA the next morning. Just from that king cannula overnight. So
right.
I don't even know how many pods that is. It's insane, right? We could figure it out. But 15 years, 365 days, probably 100 and some pods a year. She probably wear, I mean, just crazy. Over 1,200 pods maybe happened one time. And the one time it happened while she was asleep. Right? Didn't happen in the middle of the day where we would have noticed or something like that. It didn't happen in a situation where we would have noticed quicker because her blood sugar would have shot up because it didn't shoot up because of all the swimming. Like just these little happenstancy variables that kept it from being discovered right away. And it was, you know what I mean?
Right.
And look,
we always say it was just the perfect storm.
Yeah.
Like everything lined up for a horrible disaster.
Right.
Just with... And for so long, I was so angry because it's like one tiny mistake, one lapse in, you know, I don't know.
What? You can't even blame yourself, really. I mean, the cannula just kinked when you put it in.
Yeah, but, you know, it's like, well, I should have made sure that it was working and all that. And I should have been doing like real sick day management. That would have helped.
Yeah, but you know how many times people in your with diabetes get by, you know what I mean? Like they just go like, I know what I should be doing, but it's going to be okay. And 9 times out of 10, it is okay. And then
that's been me my whole life. I've never passed out from a low. I've never gone into DKA. So I kind of had this attitude of like, nah, I got it. I always got it.
Yep. I'm telling you, I raise a little girl with diabetes. That's the biggest problem that is the most difficult to address, is that it's difficult day to day to have the same, sense of we have to be on top of this that you have when you're parenting someone with type 1. Like when you're doing it as an adult, it doesn't make sense, right? You'd make yourself crazy, but yet something's going to happen at some point. But look, you know, this could happen. That cannula could have kinked 3 days before you were sick. And you probably would have figured it out. Your blood sugar would have started going up. You've been like, oh, what the hell? Oh, I just changed my site. Blah, blah, blah. But the cannula plus being sick, blah, blah, blah. And you're trying to get through it. I'm telling you, that's crazy. Well, I'm happy, obviously, that it all worked out. And really nice of you to come on the podcast and tell everybody about it. Thank you so much.
Oh, absolutely. It's like a dream come true, kind of.
Oh, do tell. I have a couple of minutes. Why am I fantastic? Now's the time, Mary-Kate. Go.
Oh, I think you know.
Yeah,
I think
I'm just teasing you. Yeah, it's fine. I'm very happy that the podcast has been valuable for you through your life, you know, through this time. So I really do appreciate you adding your story to it, because this is the kind of thing people need to hear. Like, you know, it's all well and good when nothing bad happens at the other side, but you know, this is a great experience to share, to give people the idea that you do have to be diligent, you know, like you can't just keep letting it go over and over again. It's going to catch up at some point. And man, I'm just glad that it all worked out. And so your husband, he gets there. This is the last little bit.
Oh, yeah.
He's there while you're in surgery already, is when he arrives.
So it turned, well, I didn't ever see him. When I woke up, I wake up and I see him. So I'm like, oh, thank God. But what actually happened is he was there. And this is just perfect storm. It's hilarious. They took me to labor and delivery ER. The ambulance did. And he shows up to the hospital and goes to main ER. Mm-hmm. And is at the ER front desk, like, where's my wife? Where's my wife? Da, 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 da. And by the time, you know, the ER locates me and is like, oh, she's over in L&D ER. I was already back in the OR. So, so that's how we missed each other.
Just like that. Oh my gosh. Does he know, when do you two find out together the baby situation? Or does he find out before you wake up?
Together. But I was like, kind of, you know, half there. Mm-hmm. I remember the doctor standing there and being like, he's alive, but we don't know if he's going to be, you know, fully functioning, basically. Mm-hmm. I remember her being like, you know, just very direct about it.
And tempering your expectations.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. But he, you know, obviously went to meet him without me and everything like that. So
were you with it enough to know how bad it was, or were you kind of really out of it?
I was really out of it. I thought I was with it, but then looking back, I didn't really come to for like 2 days, because they had me on, you know, a lot of pain medicine, and then I was still in DKA and yada yada.
Sure. No, I imagine. Oh, wow. Okay. All right. Well, if it's okay with you, I'm definitely calling this one Hey Jude.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, I'm thrilled that that everything's okay. Seriously, it's very kind of you. I would stay on with you a little longer and talk about other stuff, but the truth is, I'm looking back on our conversation. I think this is about as much as people can take from one episode.
I'm sad that I'm such a depressing episode.
No, not depressing. It feels like I'm on a roller coaster.
Yeah. I mean, it was.
Yeah, I feel like we've been on the tilt-a-whirl long enough now. We all need to get off.
Everybody needs to go listen to something happy.
Yeah, I'm sure there's an After Dark where someone's doing something absolutely insane. You can go listen to that. It'll probably pep you right up. Although I'm told by some people they don't like the After Darks because they find them sad, but I find them incredibly interesting. So, I don't know. Do you like them?
Yeah, they're not really my style. I've only listened to one, I think, to be honest with you.
Is it too much when people's like have so much like distress in their life?
Yeah, basically. I'm like, my life's crazy enough. Like, I don't want to, I feel the same way about like sad movies or scary movies. It's just like, I don't want to consume, you know, negativity, I guess. Like, yeah. life is crazy enough.
Yeah, it certainly is. Hey, here's my last question for you. Are you planning on having more kids?
I am. Yeah.
Yeah. You think it'll be okay?
All I can do is pray.
Did you ever figure out who gave you the flu?
No, I don't know. It was probably at work. Realistically, it was flu season. I didn't care for anyone directly that had the flu, but we did have patients there that were flu positive.
Bounces so. Around. Yeah. I take it. All right. I just like, because I there's part of me is like, I hope it's not somebody in their family. Like you know what I mean? Like that'd be horrible.
I would not be able to get over that one.
Yeah. How did your dad handle the story afterwards? Because he understands it too. Like, is it hard for him to hear?
Yeah, definitely. He's like, he's really emotional, but like keeps it on the DL. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I know, like my parents came down, you know, the next morning, and my husband's parents, and I know everybody was kind of a mess, but I didn't everybody put on a brave face for me, I guess is the point. And I didn't really wake up out of all my craziness until like day two or three. So
until you've been in a situation where a loved one is in a desperate way, you don't realize how everyone just gets very like, oh, it's fine. You look great. This is going to be okay. Like, don't worry. I told my mom not to worry 3 hours before I knew she was going to die. And I was pretty sure it was going badly. I'm like, mom, it's going to be all right. Like, there's nothing left to say. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
What are you going to do? Go, I don't know. This looks bad, mom.
This is it.
I think you better talk to Jesus because I think he's coming. So like, you know, so everyone does that thing. Because they're just trying to get you back to a good place, you know? And
exactly. Yeah.
It's wonderful. Well, listen, I'm glad you had people around you and that it all worked out. If you hold on just 1 second, I just need to talk to you for a second after we're done. But thank you so much for doing this.
Of course. I was happy to.
Oh, great. Hold on 1 second. A huge thanks to Touched by Type 1 for sponsoring this episode of the Juice Box Podcast. Check them out on their website, touchedbytype1.org, or on Facebook and Instagram. A huge thanks to Dexcom for being longtime sponsors of the Juicebox Podcast. Dexcom.com/juicebox. Head over there now. Get started today. Jalen is an incredible example of what so many experience living with diabetes. You show up for yourself and others every day, never letting diabetes define you. And that is what the Medtronic Champion community is all about. Each of us is strong, and together, we're even stronger. To hear more stories from the Medtronic Champion community, or to share your own story, visit MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox and look out online for the hashtag Medtronic Champion. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoy my full conversation with Jalen, coming up in just a moment. A diabetes diagnosis comes with a lot of new terms, and you're not going to understand most of them. That's why we made Defining Diabetes. Go to juiceboxpodcast.com, up into the menu, and click on Defining Diabetes to find the series that will tell you what all of those words mean. Short, fun, and informative, that's Defining Diabetes. Thanks for hanging out until the end. Now you're going to hear my entire conversation with Jalen. Don't forget MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox or the hashtag MedtronicChampion on your favorite social media platform.
My name is Jalen Mayfield. I am 29 years old. I live in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where I am originally from Waynesboro, Mississippi. So I've kind of traveled all over. I've just landed here in the Midwest and haven't left since.
Nice. How old were you when you were diagnosed with type 1 diabetes?
I was 14 years old when I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes.
15 years ago. Wow.
Yes.
Okay. 14 years old. What are you like? Do you remember what grade you were in?
I actually do because we have like an eighth grade promotion. So I had just had eighth grade promotion. So I was going straight into high school. So it was a summer heading into high school.
Was that particularly difficult going into high school with this new thing?
It was unimaginable. You know, I missed my entire summer. So I was going to a brand new school with, you know, our community, we brought three different schools together. So I was around a bunch of new people that I had not been going to school with. So it was hard trying to balance that while also explaining to people what type 1 diabetes was.
Did you even know, or were you just learning at the same time?
I honestly was learning at the same time. My hometown did not have an endocrinologist. So I was traveling almost over an hour to the nearest, you know, pediatrician, like endocrinologist for children. So, you know, outside of that, I didn't have any type of support in my hometown.
Was there any expectation of diabetes? Does somebody else in your family have type 1?
No, I was the first one to have type 1 in my family.
And do you have children now?
I do not.
No. Do you think you will one day?
Still thinking about it, but right now I've just been traveling, focusing on my career and myself. So,
what do you do? What's your career?
Yeah, so I am a marketing leasing specialist for a student housing company. So we oversee about 90 properties throughout the U.S. So I've been working for them for about 8 years now.
And you get to travel a lot in that job?
Yes, I experience a lot of travel. It's fun, but also difficult, especially with all your type 1 diabetes supplies and all your electronics. So it's a bit of a hassle sometimes. Mm-hmm.
What do you find that you absolutely need with you while you're traveling, diabetes-wise?
I have learned my biggest thing I need is some type of glucose. I have experienced lows, whether that's on a flight, traveling, walking through the airport. And I used to always experience just being nervous to ask for some type of snack or anything. So I just felt, I felt like I needed to always have something on me, and that has made it my travel a lot easier.
Okay. So growing up in this small town, what was your initial challenge during diagnosis, and what other challenges did you find along the way?
Yeah, I think the initial one, I felt isolated. I had no one to talk to that it was experiencing what I was going through. You know, they were, people would say, oh, I know this is like hard for you, but I was like, you really don't. Like, I just felt lonely. I didn't know, you know, people were watching everything I did. It was like, you can't eat this, you can't eat that. I felt like all of my childhood had been, you know, I don't even remember what it was like for life before diabetes at this point, because I felt like that's only thing I could focus on was trying to do a life with type 1 diabetes.
When you found yourself misunderstood, did you try to explain to people, or did you find it easier just to stay private?
I honestly just held back. I didn't really like talking about it. It was just, it felt like it was just a repeating record where I was saying things and people weren't understanding it. And I also was still in the process of learning it. So I just, you know, kept it to myself, didn't really talk about it unless I absolutely had to.
Did you eventually find people in real life that you could confide in?
I think I never really got the experience until after getting to college. And then once I graduated college and moving to an even bigger town, that's where I finally found those people where I was like, okay, there's a lot of other people that have type 1 diabetes. And, you know, there's a community out there which I had never experienced before.
Is college where you met somebody with diabetes for the first time, or just where you met more people with different ways of thinking?
So I met my first person with diabetes, actually my freshman year of high school. There was only one other person, and he had had it since he was a kid, like young, once we were like maybe born, mm-hmm. or like right after that time frame. So that was the only other person I knew until I got to college and I started meeting other people. I was a member of the band and I was an RA. So I was like, okay, there's, you know, there's a small handful of people also at my university. But then once I moved to St. Louis, and a lot of my friends I met were like med students and they were young professionals. And that's where I started really getting involved with one of my really close friends to this day. He was also type 1 diabetic. And I was like, that's who introduced me to all these different types of communities and technologies, and which is really what helped jumpstart my learning more in with type 1 diabetes.
Do you think, I mean, there was that one person in high school, but you were young. Do you really think you were ready to build a relationship and around diabetes, or did you even know the reason why that would be important at the time?
I didn't. You know, I honestly didn't think about it. I just was like, oh, there's another person in my class that's kind of going through the same thing as I am, but they've also had it a lot longer than I have. So they've kind of got it down. They don't really talk about it. And I was like, well, I don't really have much to connect with them. Connect with them on.
Yeah, no. So now once your world expands, as far as different people, different backgrounds, different places in college, you see the need to connect in real life, but there's still only a few people, but there's still value in that, right?
Correct.
What do you think that value was at the time?
I think it was just what making me feel like I was just a normal person. I just wanted that. And I needed to know that, like, you know, there was other people out there with type 1 diabetes experiencing the same type of, you know, thoughts that I was having.
When were you first introduced to the Medtronic Champions community?
Yeah. So about 2 years ago, I was, you know, I was looking around and I stumbled upon the Medtronic community. And I was like, this is something I really, really, I kind of need. You know, I said, all throughout these years, I was, you know, afraid to show my pump. I would wear long sleeves, like didn't want people to see my CGMs because I didn't want people to ask me questions. And, you know, I just felt so uncomfortable. And then I noticed seeing these people really in the Medtronic community just, they embraced it. You could see them. They weren't afraid to show it. And that was something I was really looking forward to.
How is it knowing that your diabetes technology is such an important part of your health and your care and having to hide it? What did it feel like to have to hide that diabetes technology? And how did it feel to be able to kind of let it go?
I refused to go anywhere. I would run to the bathroom. I just didn't want to do it in public because I felt like people were watching me. And that was just one of the hardest things I was trying to overcome. You know, I was fresh out of college, going into the young professional world. So, you know, going out on work events and things like that, I just I just didn't think to have it out because I was so afraid. But then once I did start, you know, embracing it and showing it, that's when the curiosity came, and it was actually genuine questions and people wanting to know more about the equipment that I'm on and how does this work and what does this mean and things like that, which made it kind of inspired me because I was like, okay, people actually do want to understand what I'm experiencing with type 1 diabetes.
What did you experience when the internet came into play and now suddenly as easy as a hashtag and you can meet all these other people who are living with diabetes as well? Can you tell me how that is either different or valuable, I guess, compared to meeting a few people in real life?
Absolutely. I think if you look back from when I was first diagnosed to now, I would have never thought of, like, you know, searching anything for someone with, you know, with type 1 diabetes. And now it's like, it's all I see. You know, you can easily search Medtronic Champions and you see people that pop up and you're like, wow, look at all this content. And I think that's something that kind of just motivates me, and which is how I've kind of came out of my shell and started embracing more and posting more on my social media with about, you know, how I live with type 1 diabetes. And I think that's something that I hope can inspire everyone else.
What was it like having more personal, intimate relationships in college with type 1?
I think it was kind of hard to explain, you know, just for example, like no one really knows, understands like what a low is. And I think that was a very hard thing for me to explain. Like you know, it can happen in any moment and I'm sweating. I'm just really like not all there. And I'm trying to explain like, hey, this is what's going on. I need your help. And I think that was something that was hard for me to, you know, I did talk to people about it. So when this happened, they were like, oh, you know, what's going on with you? I'm like, I'm actually a type 1 diabetic. Yeah. This is what's going on. I need your help.
What about once you've had an experience like that in front of someone, was it always bonding or did it ever have people kind of step back and be maybe more, I don't know, leery of your relationship?
After I would tell someone I had type 1 diabetes after some type of event or anything, like they were kind of more upset with me that I didn't tell them up front because they were like, you know, I care about you as a person. I would have loved to known this about you. It's not anything you should have to hide from me. And I think that was a lot of the realization that I was going through with a lot of people.
Okay. Let me ask you this. So now we talked about what it was like to be low and to have that more kind of emergent situation. But what about when your blood sugar has been high or stubborn and you're not thinking correctly, but it's not as obvious maybe to you or to them?
Yeah. So I go through my same experiences when I have high blood sugars. You know, I can tell, like, from my coworkers, for example, I didn't really talk to, you know, I'll backtrack. When I visit multiple sites for work, I usually don't announce it. And so sometimes I'm working throughout the day. I might have snacked, forgot to take some insulin, and my blood sugar is running high and I'm a little bit more irritable. I'm all over the place. And I'm like, let me stop. Hey guys, I need to like take some insulin. I'm sorry. I didn't tell you guys I'm a diabetic. So you may be wondering why I'm kind of just a little bit snippy, you know? So I like to make sure I do that now going forward, because that's something I noticed and it was kind of hindering me with my career because I was, you know, getting irritable because I'm working nonstop and I'm forgetting to take a step back and focus on my diabetes.
Right. Hey, with the advent of new technology like Medtronic CGM and other diabetes technology, can you tell me how that's improved your life and those interactions with people?
Yeah, I can. I feel confident knowing that it's working in the background. As someone, and I've always avidly said it, I have been someone that's really bad with counting my carbs. So sometimes I kind of undershoot it because I'm scared, but it allows me to just know that, hey, it's got my back if I forget something. And I think that allows me to have a quick lunch, and then I'm able to get back into the work day because it's such a fast-paced industry that I work in. So sometimes it is easy to forget. And so I love that I have that system that's keeping track of everything for me.
Let me ask you one last question. When you have interactions online with other people who have type 1 diabetes, what social media do you find the most valuable for you personally? Like, what platforms do you see the most people and have the most good interactions on?
Yeah, I've had tremendous interactions on Instagram. That's where I've kind of seen a lot of other diabetics reach out to me and ask me questions. I've commented and been like, hey, you're experiencing this too. But I've recently also been seeing TikToks and, you know, finding on that side of it. I didn't, you know, see the videos and the fun videos. And I'm like, I would love to do stuff like that, but I just never have the courage. So I'm seeing people make like just the fun engagement videos now, which I love, you know, really bringing that awareness to diabetes.
Yeah. Isn't it interesting? Maybe you don't know this, but there's some sort of an age cutoff somewhere where there is an entire world of people with type 1 diabetes existing on Facebook mm-hmm. that don't go into TikTok or Instagram and vice versa.
Yeah.
And I do think it's pretty broken down by, you know, when that platform was most popular for those people by age. But your younger people, I'm acting like I'm 100 years old, but younger people seem to enjoy video more.
Yes, I think it's just because it's something you see. And so it's like, and I think the one thing, and obviously it's a big stereotype around diabetes, is you don't look like you have diabetes. And that's something I always faced. And so when I see other people that are just, you know, normal, everyday people, and I'm like, they have type 1 diabetes just like me. They're literally living their life, having fun. That's just something you want to see it, because you don't get to see people living their everyday lives with diabetes. And I think that's something I've really enjoyed.
Yeah. What are your health goals? When you go to the endocrinologist and you make a plan for the next few months, what are you hoping to achieve, and where do you struggle and where do you see your successes?
I'll be honest, I was not someone who was as, you know, involved in my diabetes. I wasn't really focused on my health. And that was something that, you know, you go into an endocrinologist and you get these results back and it's not what you want to hear. It makes you nervous. It makes you scared. And so I personally, for myself, you know, I was like, this is my chance to change. I know there's people that are living just like me, everyday lives, and they can keep their A1Cs and their blood sugars under control. How can I do this? So I go in with, you know, I would like to see it down a certain number of points each time. I would love for my doctor to be like, hey, I see you're entering your carbs. I see you're, you know, you're not having lows. You're not running high too often. That's my goal. And I've been seeing that. And that's what motivates me every time I go to the endocrinologist, where I don't dread going. It's like an exciting visit for me.
So you like to set a goal for yourself and then for someone to acknowledge it, to give you kind of that energy to keep going for the next goal.
Yeah, I feel as a type 1 diabetic, for me, and it's a lot to balance. It's a hard, hard journey.
Yeah.
And so I want someone, when I go in, I want to be able to know, like, hey, I see what you're doing. Let's work together to do this. You don't want to be put down like, you know, you're doing horrible. It's not going to motivate you, because you're already fighting a tough battle.
Right.
So just having that motivation and acknowledging the goods and also how we can improve, that's what really has been the game changer for me in the past 2 years.
Jalen, I appreciate you spending this time with me. This was terrific. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
If you enjoyed Jalen's story, check out MedtronicDiabetes.com/juicebox. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back soon with another episode of the Juice Box Podcast. The episode you just heard was professionally edited by Wrong Way Recording, wrongwayrecording.com.